Thank you, Jason. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Thank you to the CFA for inviting me. It is an honor and a distinct pleasure to be in your midst this afternoon. My topic today is digital economies. There is a subtitle, but let me add to it. I want to talk about the insights that digital economies harbor for the future of markets, of money, and indeed even of democratic politics. Now, we seem to be besotted with technological change, which makes perfect sense, does it not? After all, technology is to society that which mutation is to biology. It disrupts adaptive behavior, and it gives the wheel of history another twirl. Having said that, it is incumbent upon me, right at the outset, to warn you that I am no evangelist for digital economies. Indeed, I stand in front of you this afternoon as a skeptical enthusiast. A contradiction in terms, I know, but after all, I am a living, breathing contradiction. Am I not a Greek economist? Seriously now. Technological fixes to time-honored problems are all the rage these days. Bitcoin is meant to fix money. Social media are seen as the tyrant's greatest enemy. Networked robots will fix Japan's demographics. The internet is often portrayed as a solution to our flagging democratic processes. And yes, indeed, studying video game or other digital economies is promoted as an alternative to tired old economics, mainstream economic analysis. These claims are fascinating, and they do harbor a number of interesting insights, which I want to bring out. But at the same time, they are dubious, and they are full of phony promises. So I shall begin with several basic lessons from the study of the social economies that emerge spontaneously within video game communities, lessons that you may find interesting in your real-life experience. Then I shall move to digital money, Bitcoin in particular, to democratic politics, to the future of corporations in the light of all that, and indeed to the future of capitalism, and in particular to democratic capitalism. Now, as they say, at the beginning there was arbitrage. So let me begin at the beginning with arbitrage. The dream of arbitrage, of buying low and selling high, is the driver of all commerce. But it is also its own worst enemy, in the sense that if everybody is trying to pursue it, the potential for arbitrage disappears. And then, when it does disappear, we have equilibrium, which, of course, is the holy grail of us economists. The quicker equilibrium is achieved, the greater the market's efficiency and the worse the prospects for profiting from arbitrage. This is why the speed with which markets equilibrate is of great importance to everyone. Digitization ought to produce instant equilibration. Speed and the transparency that the internet offers should in theory eliminate arbitrage. But as high frequency trading has shown, allowing Mr. Michael Lewis to make a tidy profit from his last book, technology throws its own spanner in the works of competition by creating new forms of rent-seeking behavior based on minutely differential ultra-high speeds. Now, a couple of years ago, as Jason said, I had the opportunity to study the sophisticated barter economy of a particular video game called Team Fortress 2, TF2, while I worked with the good people at Valve Corporation in nearby Bellevue. Players of TF2 energetically trade many digital items in a secondary market for these items, items that come to their initial possession either through skill or simply by purchasing them on the store of the company called Steam for real dollars. Now, the reason why I'm bothering you with these video gamers communities is that they are an excellent source of insight regarding the effect of perfect information on behavior, on arbitrage, on equilibration. They act in the panopticon environment of the internet in which everybody sees at the same time all the bids and all the asks, and not just all the trades. This is unique. You don't have any stock market information on such data. On a personal note, let me confess that the idea of studying such a big data set is an economist's wet dream. In our standard work, we are stuck with econometrics. Now, let me tell you something, but you have to promise not to tell anyone else. Econometrics is a travesty. It has two problems. The first problem that econometrics has is that the reduced form, the equation or systems of equations that we test for consistency with our data, this reduced form can be shown to be consistent with an infinity of competing theories. So what does this mean? It means that it is impossible to discriminate between competing theories on the basis of empiricism. Secondly, you only need to look at the way economic data is compiled to make sure that you will never want to use it. It's a bit like eating sausages if you witness the way that they are manufactured. In sharp contrast to our incapacity to perform truly scientific tests in normal economic settings, video gamers' economies are a marvelous test bed for meaningful experimentation. Not only do we have the full information set, making sampling, statistical sampling, absolutely superfluous. But more importantly, we can change the economy's underlying values, rules, settings, even relative prices, and then sit back and observe how the community responds, how relative prices change further, how behaviors evolve. In short, we can play the role both of an omniscient and an omnipotent god, an economist's paradise. But let me go back to this study of arbitrage in that particular video game community, TF2. Does the perfect and symmetrical information that every player possesses within that community, does it mean that there are no opportunities for arbitrage? One might have expected that it would. The answer is no. Arbitrage opportunities seem to survive perfect information. Transparency does not kill off the prospect of trading one's way into a worthy bundle of profit. Before demonstrating this result to you, based on this study, let me state that I had expected to find evidence of two things. Firstly, I was expecting to find that some item, some commodity within that world, would evolve into the role of money, and that that economy would soon become monetized. Like, for instance, cigarettes become the currency unit in prison. And secondly, I expected to see arbiters disappear. The reason why I was expecting monetization is because history teaches us that barter economies, as they become more sophisticated, cease to be barter economies. They develop money, and therefore there is no way that you can have, in history, a sophisticated barter economy. It's like having developed hugely sophisticated training wheels for professional cyclists. It would be silly. Is this what we found? No. This close study of the TF2 economy revealed a much more complex picture, one in which barter still prevails, even though the volume of trading is skyrocketing and the sophistication of the participants' economic behavior is progressing in leaps and bounds. We found that some items did indeed acquire the characteristics, the features of a currency. But then all of a sudden, another competing item would challenge them and take over. We discovered at the same time that there are islands within the community, groups within the community, within which some item does acquire the role of currency, but that item and that currency fails to win the accolade of being the universal currency of the whole community. This is interesting, because it indicates that, say, in the international arena, there seems to be no natural tendency for some currency to dominate, to become the reserve currency, and to enjoy the exorbitant privilege of, let's say, the United States dollar of the last decades. Which perhaps means that if some currency, like the dollar, does seem to be the reserve currency, then that the explanation for that should be sought somewhere else. Like where else? Like, for instance, geopolitical dominance. Just a thought. Now, returning to my study of the arbitrage possibilities in this economy, The lack of an evolved currency forced me to spend quite a bit of time trying to produce a complicated index of arbitrage opportunities. In this diagram, what you see is the time series of that index of arbitrage opportunities. For the period between November 2011 and March 2012, in real continuous time, we see the evolution of the room that players had to make gains through arbitrage. The peaks represent moments when there was a great deal of room for arbitrage, while the line thickness reflects the volume of actual trades. It is no great surprise that these peaks coincided with the Christmas sale and the launch of new items, because these changes took time, well, created circumstances where the community had to take its time to learn how to price these new items. And here's the crux. If this community of switched-on, eager, perfectly well-informed traders can still leave room for considerable and variable arbitrage, then the efficient market hypothesis, according to which there is no room for systematic gains or profit from buying and selling, is plainly false. Well, that some of us have always known to be the case. It is ever so nice, however, to see it in full technicolor, or at least in blue. Now, before I move on to the future of money in the internet era, which is my next topic, I thought you might be interested to look at some data on the grand topic of the day, inequality. Just as prior to 2008, the Federal Reserve was fooled by low price inflation, when the real problem was asset price inflation, so to today, we're facing the problem of knowing that our societies are undermined by inordinate levels of wealth inequality, when in reality we can only observe data on income inequality, and the two are not the same thing. Wealth is very hard to compute. If anything, it is as radically unobservable as the source of social power is. Indeed, very few countries report on wealth inequality statistics. Two that do are Sweden and the United Kingdom. Interestingly, it is quite straightforward to compute wealth distributions within a community of video game players. How? Well, remember, we're omniscient. So we know the stock of items that each player owns at every moment in time. We observe the exchange rates between these items. So we can compute the value of the stock that belongs to each individual player at every point in time. And hey presto, we have our wealth distribution at every moment in time. Now, one thing we can do is to trace the evolution of wealth inequality through time in these games. In this slide, we see the time series of wealth inequality in a particular video game community called Pardew, involving some 400,000 players, as it unfolded over a period of 1,200 days. The sharp reduction you see somewhere in the middle of the diagram, of the timeline, and which is blown up in the inset, concerns an experiment in which players were invited over Christmas to donate gifts to one another. You can see the sharp fall in wealth inequality following this festive indulgence. And notice the quick return of inequality, even if not to the original level, once the festive spirit subsided. What I think you will enjoy the most, however, is the juxtaposition of our video game community's wealth inequality data against the wealth inequality data from Sweden and the United Kingdom. You can see that the three Lorentz curves almost coincide, raising fears that perhaps our real-life societies, at least Sweden and the United Kingdom, are not much different, horror of horrors, to this video game community in terms of wealth inequality. The only substantial difference lies in the fact that, thankfully, a social safety net, the welfare state, comes in the middle and prevents that blue line from hitting the horizontal axis in the case of Sweden and the United Kingdom, This matters because when people die of starvation, we have a problem. But not so much when video game players, have very few digital items that they crave. To conclude, there is a wealth of information and insights that we can glean from watching people play multiplayer games. But at this point, I must warn that these observations and insights, however interesting they might be, are utterly devoid of macroeconomic content. Micro content, a great deal. Macro content, none. Robert Radford was a British prisoner of war, a pilot whose plane was shot over Germany and who ended up in a POW camp. When he got out, he authored in 1945 a splendid paper which was published in Economica, a renowned academic economic journal. And in this article, which I highly recommend, by the way, he recounts how a fully-fledged pure exchange market economy emerged spontaneously within his POW camp. What happened was this. Every second week or every month, the Red Cross would deliver to each prisoner a neat little parcel containing some marmalade, some tea, some coffee, some cigarettes, goodies. And then immediately afterwards, when they would open those boxes, those parcels, the prisoners would start trading with one another. So the Frenchman would go to the Englishman and say, I've got some useless tea, would you like to trade it for your coffee? Very quickly, trading boards, spot markets, even a futures market, insurance markets emerged in the camp. Cigarettes naturally became the currency. And average prices began to reflect the quantity of money of cigarettes in the camp. So, for instance, he recounts how on nights when there was heavy bombardment by the RAF or the US Air Force nearby, and everybody was very anxious, there was price deflation in the camp. Why? Because they would smoke a lot of those cigarettes, the quantity of money would come down, and therefore you'd have deflation. Now, rereading Radford's paper, after having experienced and studied video game community social economies, made me realize how similar that POW camp economy is to video game economies. And how these economies differ from the real economies that you live in. What's the difference? The lack of a labor market and the lack of a money market. The two markets that give really existing capitalism its character and which makes macroeconomics so different to microeconomics. In the POW camp, the traded products were produced exogenously and thrown into the camp almost as if it was manna from heaven by the Red Cross. Similarly, in video game communities, there are two ways of gaining items of importance to you as a player. One is through these item drops, manna from heaven, from the company. The longer you play, the more goodies you get. Or secondly, through trading or skill. But the production of those commodities is just as exogenous as in the POW camp. Now, in the POW camp, Radford tells us that there was labor. Some impecunious prisoners would offer their valet services or barber services to other officers. So labor did exist, but the labor market did not. Similarly, in the video game communities, production happens in the sense that independent developers produce shields and guns and HUD and earmuffs, digital designs, which then they sell through the app store of the video game company to other fellow players. Just like Apple and Google encourage developers to monetize their designs through the iTunes or Google Play. But that is not a labor market. This is a market for produced items. Money markets, completely absent. In the POW camp, Radford tells us that a fledgling market for lending cigarettes emerged, but it crashed very quickly because of the high default rates and the impossibility of institutionally exacting interest payments. In my study of these video game communities, financial services are absent. These absences of labor and money markets render digital economies macroeconomically meaningless. And this is important, because if we're going to use any of these insights, like the ones that I have put on the screen for you, we should remember that we cannot easily transfer these insights from these worlds into the real economies. With this cautionary note, I'm now going to proceed to the next topic, the future of money. Well, money not only makes the world go round, but it is also one of the reasons that purely digital economies are macroeconomically relevant. Nevertheless, one must have been living in a cave not to have heard of this full digital innovation that has been on everyone's lips over the last few months, Bitcoin. If the hype is to be believed, Bitcoin is the future of money. A mathematical solution to the problem of currency manipulation by unscrupulous politicians and or unaccountable central bankers. So what can we learn from Bitcoin, but also from in-game currencies, about the present and the future of money? Let me begin with in-game currencies, like Linden dollars in a game called Second Life, or the so-called interstellar credits in EVE Online. Well, analytically, they are similar to the prisoner of war camp's cigarettes, analytically. They are exogenously determined. They're given. They are not endogenously produced within these economies. The only difference is that, unlike in the POW camp, where the quantity of cigarettes is fixed, in in-game currencies, the quantity of that money is exogenous but not fixed, to the extent that players can buy these units or add to the stock of money by exchanging dollars for these in-game currencies. Game companies, in this case, play the role of central banks, increasing or decreasing the exchange rate between those in-game currencies and the dollar, in a bid either to deflate bubbles that occur within these economies or to reflate them after a bust. All this is anathema to the Bitcoin community. For them, the task is to cut out the middleman, to institute a digital currency that is immune to manipulation by anyone. For them, the issue is not whether money will be digital or not, but whether it will be fully decentralized as the internet, and not centralized as Microsoft is, the Soviet Union, the Federal Reserve, MasterCard, any hierarchical organization. Now, before we delve deeper into the debates on Bitcoin and the future of money, allow me to just come clean on what my view is. Bitcoin, in my book, is above all else a beautiful algorithm. It is a brilliant answer in search of a worthy question, a breathtaking solution to as yet undiscovered problems. So contrary to the evangelists of Bitcoin and their grand proclamations, democratizing and depoliticizing money will not be Bitcoin's contribution to humanity. Indeed, it should not be. It shouldn't replace government-issued money. Why? Because in my estimation, no depoliticized currency is capable of powering an advanced industrial society. What makes the Bitcoin algorithm beautiful is that it does make possible a decentralized network within which trust is built because everyone is monitoring everyone else. There is no sentry. There is no central authority, no guardian, no Leviathan who may become tyrannical or fall asleep on the job like regulators did prior to 2008. Instead, what we have is a benign Benthamite panopticon where everyone is kept honest because everybody is watching them. And everybody is watching everybody else watching everybody else. It is truly splendid in that regard. But it is not a sound foundation for an alternative monetary system. Why not? To begin with, it is tiny in size. The total global value in real money of Bitcoin is less than the bailout funds given by, given in inverted commas, by European taxpayers to one smallish Greek bank in 2013. So far, Bitcoin is a digital tulip. Or to paraphrase Keynes, it is a bubble on a whirlpool of speculation, rather than a bubble on a growing stream of enterprise. Of course, Bitcoin enthusiasts will argue and will tell us that what matters is its growth potential. I'm not convinced. Bitcoin suffers from two separate problems that should not be confused with one another. I call them the security problem and the economic problem. The security problem you all know. It's the danger of having your computer hacked and your bitcoins disappear in the night. And if you don't trust your computer and you give it to an unregulated bitcoin bank, then you are fearful that the banker will run away with your bitcoins or that somebody will hack into that bank like it happened with Mt. Gox. That is a security problem. I'm not that interested in it. I'm interested in the economic problem. Whereas the security problem may wreck bitcoin, suppose bitcoin is not wrecked by the security problem and it grows into macroeconomic relevance. Well, then I'm very much afraid that Bitcoin will wreck the economy. Why? Because Bitcoin is designed to mimic the gold standard, the monetary system that caused one depression after the other in the 19th century all the way to 1929, and which was replaced because capitalism cannot breathe under an exogenous quantity of money. To see why this is so, recall that Bitcoin's value comes from its scarcity. And its scarcity is designed into its algorithm so that its quantity grows on the basis of a negative exponential function that will see to it that the rate of growth constantly diminishes until it becomes zero in a few years' time, and then we're going to have a fixed quantity of money completely. So if Bitcoin catches on as a proper currency rather than a tulip, a store of value, a speculative asset, then by definition, the rate of increase in the quantity of goods and services purchased by Bitcoin will outpace the rate of increase in the supply of Bitcoins. Now this means that the available quantity of Bitcoins per unit of output is going to be coming down steadily as output increases, thus causing deflation, falling prices. And why is this a problem, I hear you ask? Well, it is a problem because even if all prices fall at once, this is not neutral. Because there is one thing that doesn't fall, your debt. Your debt does not fall when all prices come down because your debt is a stock. And that is going to precipitate the worst that capitalism can ever encounter, a debt deflationary spiral. Think Great Depression back in the 30s, think Greece today. So as long as our economies feature large debts, a macroeconomically significant Bitcoin would be detrimental to stability, prosperity, and economic growth. Video game economies and internet-based digital money like Bitcoin, which are free from governments and states, are exceptionally interesting, but as long as they lack debt markets, they will remain peripheral to really existing capitalism. Well, one may retort that perhaps if it would be a godsend to reconfigure our economies so that they are debt-free. Well, but let me remind you, ladies and gentlemen, that debt is to capitalism that which hell is to Christianity. Seriously unpleasant and absolutely essential. Capitalism unleashed incredible productive powers by reversing the three stages of economic activity. Under feudalism, before capitalism, we had production, distribution, and finance. The peasant would cultivate the land and would produce agricultural production. The lord would send the sheriff to get his share, distribution, and then the lord would sell his share in local markets, get money, and then become a moneylender, financialization. Capitalism stood this sequence on its head. Entrepreneurs begin first with debt. They borrow money in order to then distribute it. So financialization comes before distribution, and distribution comes before production. The borrowed money is used in order to pay the landlord rent, the laborer wage, suppliers return to their capital. That multiplication happens before production has begun. And then production happens as the last, final, third stage. And then effectively what we're doing, just to look at it from a science fiction point of view, it is as if the entrepreneur takes her hand, pushes it through the timeline into the future, grabs a value that has not been created yet, brings it into the present, invests it in current production to produce the value that then will be returned to the future with interest, one hopes. Debt is of the essence for really existing capitalism precisely because of this structure. While too much debt, like too much of anything, can be a terrible thing, it is true that no debt, no capitalism. This is why the fantasy of a future with stateless digital money is dangerous. The built-in deflationary tendency of currencies like Bitcoin makes debt unsustainable. And it is also why our video game communities, despite their highly sophisticated economies, remain macroeconomically irrelevant as they lack debt and indeed labor markets. One last wrinkle, which is perhaps educational and worthwhile to mention, is that we seem to collectively have forgotten the history of money. We tend to think of money like cigarettes in the POW camp. An easy, sort of divisible and a durable commodity which can lubricate trade and liberate us from barter. There is an element of truth in that. Nevertheless, historically, this is what archaeologists tell us. Let's go back to Mesopotamia, today's Iraq. We know from records that 3,500 years before Christ, ancient accountants were painstakingly carving logs of who owed what to whom, of how much grain each resident within some jurisdiction had stored at a communal warehouse, of how much barley was owed to those working in the temple. And what is beguiling is that the unit of account often took the form of silver coins that in fact did not even circulate and had not even been minted. Indeed, everyday use of coins as a means of exchange was not witnessed for several thousands of years after it was used in order to record debt. So once again, we see that debt is at the heart of monetized macroeconomies. Unless digital economies develop debt markets and digital cryptocurrencies overcome their debt deflationary tendencies, which make debt and growth unsustainable, the future of money will continue to feature central banks, even if it circulates through our digital wallets. Having said that, it would be precisely wrong on my part to claim that the beautiful Bitcoin algorithm is irrelevant from the perspective of monetary policy. As one who has been engaging in the Eurozone debate, it occurred to me recently that Bitcoin-like technologies and currencies could be developed at the national level in order to alleviate the monetary asphyxiation of member states of the Eurozone. I just mentioned this as an example of applications of the blockchain that Bitcoin is producing that we have not even started to imagine yet how it could be used efficiently. In summary, while Bitcoin is not the future of money, and in-game currencies are easier to manage than the euro or the dollar because these economies are macroeconomic simpletons, Bitcoin's technology offers us opportunities for creating new instruments that are supportive of existing monetary policy. Indeed, of democratizing state money without replacing it. We still have not worked out the best way of utilizing these algorithms. It is the reason why I call Bitcoin a beautiful algorithm that offers brilliant solutions to problems that we have not yet articulated. Now, I mentioned democratizing money, which brings to mind the ubiquitous claims that the internet is a democratizing force in society, that it can encourage citizens to become involved, to overcome their apathy, and therefore to reinvigorate our flagging democracies. Is that right? The answer must yet again be nuanced. It is helpful to begin by distinguishing between e-government and in democracy. E-government is about using existing institutions with greater efficiency and transparency. But e-democracy surely must mean something more than that. What? Allow me to suggest a trip to ancient Athens, where the concept emerged. That's what you get when you have a Greek addressing you. Athenian democracy can be dismissed because of its unappetizing reliance on slaves and its exclusion of women. But let me put it this way to you. The Athenians invented neither slavery nor sexism. What they did invent was a very strange notion. The notion of a citizen who enjoyed not only free speech, but also equal say in the final formulation of policy, independently of whether he was rich, comfortably off, or indeed a manual laborer. Aristotle's definition of democracy is telling in this regard. A constitution in which the freeborn and the poor control the government. Athenian democrats invoke the demos, the people, in a bid to assert the rights of the poor, not just to equal say, not just to have a voice, but more importantly, to have a voice of equal weight. One may reasonably argue that direct democracy is impossible in complex societies like ours, and this is probably right. But there is a hidden presumption in this quick statement. The presumption that while we would like something like Athenian democracy, we can't have it because of transaction costs and other technical difficulties. But let me ask you this. Suppose that using the internet it suddenly became practicable to have direct e-democracy. Would we want it? My answer is, personally, I would. But I very strongly suspect I would be in a tiny minority. I believe that a fair reading of contemporary liberal democracy confirms that the devaluation of citizenship was not unintentional. The liberal democracies that a democracy is meant to rescue from apathy have their roots not in ancient Athens, but in constitutions of a Protestant pedigree. A constitution is good in this sense if it exploits efficiently the fallen nature of man, his selfishness, and his propensity is put into the use of the common will by harnessing it. You can almost smell the polished pews, hear the thundering voice of the preacher. And if you were ever a student of economics or political economy, the image will come to you of Adam Smith's invisible hand, working subretentionally behind our backs in order to take our selfishness and convert it into public virtues in spite of ourselves, not because of our will. Making our way from Adam Smith's Scotland to the United States, it is perhaps arguable that the founding fathers invented the idea of the American people and of their sovereignty as a means of instituting a stable government over which the people would not have direct control. Though representatives were to be elected, the Federalists were particularly wary of a ruling people, of a ruling demos. The multitude was to stay out of political deliberation and be contented that they are represented in Congress by their social superiors. And who were these? The merchants. Then, perhaps the corporations now. Seen from this perspective, is it not the case that perhaps voter apathy is not an accident, but a design feature of our liberal democracies? I think this question is pertinent, especially when we discuss the impact of the internet on democratic institutions for a very simple reason. If democracy is found floundering by accident, then perhaps the internet can offer a solution. But if it's not by accident, then a technical fix is not the solution. In large complex societies, where citizenship rights are widespread, representative democracy, increasingly intermediated by the internet, is a must. But for people to rule, for demos to rule, for democracy to make a comeback, we need much, much more than technology. Unless the balance of power between the economic and the political sphere, with an economic sphere that has decoupled and has acquired its own life, unless these two are brought closer together, perhaps genuine democracy will never be possible? Will technology help? I shall finish off with this, but before that, since I mentioned corporations and corporate power, let me remind you that there is something quite weird happening around and within corporations. They are market-free zones, as Coase has taught us. They are based on hierarchies, and their allocation of resources within corporations happens very similarly, at least analytically, to the way the Soviet Union was working. Can this begin to change? And will technology and the internet help? Multiplayer video games are breaking down one important barrier that makes a corporation sustainable in market societies: the barrier between producer and consumer. What is the product that a video game company produces and supplies to its customers? It is the game universe itself. But the players themselves are part of that universe. And through their inventive play and economic behavior, they help produce the universe which they are customers of, consumers of. Now this is not going to, even though it is a very interesting blurring of the distinction between production and consumption, by itself it does not change corporate structure, because corporations, if anything, benefit from the fact that consumers add value which they can then monetize as corporations. However, as time goes by, something else happens. Players are acquiring the tools to build their own digital universes, and at the same time, salaried developers working for these corporations get the idea that they could split from the corporation and work for themselves in conjunction with some of the consumers who are now bona fide producers in their own right. So the combination of the increasing input of consumers in the production process of the digital universe, secondly, the near zero marginal costs, and thirdly, the removal of the borderline dividing developer and consumer, combine to annul the raison d'etre behind corporations. You may understandably put it to me that while this may all be true regarding video games, it is not true regarding manufacturing. Well, let's say that we throw a 3D printer in the mix. Maybe that would make a difference, even though 3D printing doesn't involve zero marginal costs. Marginal costs will fall immensely. And moreover, the actual production, the actual 3D printer, is not going to be owned by the corporation that has designed the product, but it will be working, operating more like a public utility. In this world, what will the role of Ford or Toyota be? Assuming that the problems of crash testing the cars and seeking approval can be communally dealt with, future corporations will lack the oligarchic hierarchical power structure that they now have. Maybe I'm running ahead of the times. But it is not inconceivable that multiplayer video games, 3D printers, and flat management associations may hold the key to a mass social transformation that may allow in the future for the wholesale reintegration of the economic and political sphere, which, as I argued before, is a prerequisite for a return to democracy. Perhaps then, once corporate power is depleted, we can talk about democracy again properly. And thus, I have come to the end of this exploration. I promise to appear in front of you as a skeptical enthusiast about digital economies and their lessons for us, to give you examples of insights that we can glean from fully digital markets on arbitrage, on trading patterns, wealth inequality, money, even democratic politics. As promised, I also flagged the severe limits of these insights, highlighting the absence from digital universes, at least so far, of the two markets that make capitalism tick: debt markets and labor markets. Those of you who came to this talk anticipating an evangelical account that will transport you to a radically different place may feel cheated. To you, I bring solace in the words of T.S. Eliot, who encouraged us to keep on exploring, promising that the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and get to know the place for the first time. Thank you.